From childhood stories like Peter and the Wolf to groundbreaking documentaries like Jamie and Jim Dutcher's Living with Wolves to the powerful book Wolf Nation, the plight of wolves and people's mission to eliminate them defies description. Wolves have long been a central part of the American image. They exert their strongest hold on our imagination, kindling fear, fascination, and love. Hi, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, we thank you for being a part of it, because without you, there would be no us. So thank you for joining us again. Wolves have long been a central part of the American image. They do exert their strongest hold on our imagination, kindling fear, fascination, and love. And I'm going to set the stage for why I personally am beyond thrilled and honored to be spending time with our guests this next hour to learn more about one of my magnificent obsessions, the story of wolves and our treatment of them. For the past 20 years, Brenda Peterson has been a strong voice in the fight to restore this keystone species, the wild American wolves, and thus the landscape and ecology of the North American continent. Why do wolves elicit fear in people? Because they do. Many people are obsessed with bringing about their extinction. Wolves have been trapped, tortured, poisoned, and almost hunted to extinction more than once. But wolves also have champions, advocates, and heroes. Brenda Peterson is all of those. She is an author of 20 books, most of which, if not all of them, are award-winning. And for the past two decades, she has studied and written about animals, especially marine animals and wolves. She is the founder of the Seattle-based grassroots conservation group, Seal Sitters. And since 1993, she has contributed environmental commentary to NPR and is a frequent commentator to the Huffington Post. Brenda, we finally made it after talking for so long, and I'm thrilled to have you speak with us about Wolf Nation, the life, death, and return of wild American wolves.
Thank you, Gina, for the dialogue. I really appreciate it.
I want to start by reading the very first note that I wrote when I started reading part one of your book, What We Almost Lost and Historic Rage. My note said, I sit and read this after returning from hours of looking for wildlife in Crested Butte, Colorado. I have actually stopped breathing. I'm having a physical reaction to what I am reading, and I have to step away. So when I was reading that the other day to prepare for the show, I thought to myself, how dramatic, Gina, really? And so I reread those first pages, and guess what? Same reaction. So to kind of curate my own emotions around this show and the important messages we want to put out there, I think I'd like to do first a bit of the ugly and cover the rage, and then focus on all of the many good things, the joyful things, and the inspirational stories that your book helps all of us to get on board with. And that's the critical piece to me. It's why we have to protect them. And your book does both. It sets the stage for you better pay attention. And then for a lot of the book, you're soaring about hope. So is that okay with you as the author?
That's good, yes.
Okay, so you start with some pretty powerful examples, my friend, of the magnitude and scope of the sheer hate that people have towards wolves, including a quote which has to jump out at people. Wolves are terrorists on the order of Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. Now, if that doesn't stop you in your tracks, like, that is true. People hate them as much as they hated that man. So just share with us some snippets of those first 20 pages that really grabs us and emotionally connects us. It explains my reaction, I'm sure thousands of others. What is the historic rage? Why is there such furies against this magnificent animal?
Well, there are two operative words here, Gina. One is terror. And when you have not had experience with wolves, or you've been raised in a very prejudicial situation where wolves are the enemy of your cattle or your people, or you have decided that wolves are irrationally something to be terrorizing you, then you are free to treat the enemy or the terrorist with any kind of brutality or cruelty. And we knew that from our human wars, you know, where we make the enemy less than human. So what we've done, since wolves are not human to begin with, is made them less than animal. We've forgotten all the science. We've forgotten the ways in which wolves help the landscape. And we've simply branded them the enemy or the terrorist. And if you look at the first pages of that first chapter, which is called An Historic Rage, you'll see that anywhere if you go in the West, you'll see signs, things like wolves are illegal immigrants. And you yourself did a show on that in August.
Right, right.
Comparing our treatment of wolves to immigrants. And, you know, prejudice is prejudice. Wherever it's, whether it's human-human or human-animal, prejudice is irrational. You can't reason with someone who is swept up in fear and terror. And we know that from our own emotional lives. So if you project that fear and terror onto an animal, and then you make them the enemy, you can do the most horrific things to that enemy. And I talk about it with wildlife services, which is our government's way for the past 100 or so years of managing wolves, which is lethal management with no, you know, it's consumptive, it's lethal. It's all about killing what we are afraid of.
So do you think people would be surprised, most people as I was, the level of emotion? I mean, I cover some pretty heavy-duty subjects, but this one, it went way beyond that. As my, I'm an empath. I cry easily, proud of it. But this went a lot deeper than that. And you know that because we've had some emotional conversations, me being the one that's saying, Brenda, give me a lifeline here. But I never heard of the Wildlife Service, and I want to read a quick quote from your book. Mm-hmm. Wildlife Services is one of the most opaque and least accountable agencies, protested Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio. They are a world unto themselves, and that's a world we are not allowed to see into. And I'm reading it, and of course, everybody thinks of, you know, the National Parks and Recreation and National Wildlife Service. No, it's not that. And then I tried to dig in and find anything that I could, and I'm a pretty good digger down. Nothing. I can find nothing. So who are they, and what are they doing with billions of dollars of taxpayers' money? It's
they
our money.
They are killing a wolf a day.
Oh.
On page 9 in that chapter, they are killing a wolf a day. And they are secret. They are very hard to suss out. The New York Times last year did an editorial about wildlife services and the statistics, which are they have spent $1 billion of taxpayer money in 2014 killing wild animals. And this doesn't just affect the wild animals. It affects things like bird watchers, because when you kill, you know, a lot of these wild animals, you deplete red-winged blackbirds and starlings, and you also have all these cougars and black bears that are killed. It's really this horrible war against wildlife that's going on with our money. Even though, if you look at survey after survey, we want wolves on the landscape, and we want them to repopulate and help our ecosystems.
So one of the times I had a put the book down. And I mean, I'm really not being a drama queen. You just have to sit with some of these things and just come back. And there was a whistleblower, Doug McKenna, who worked for Wildlife Services.
Yes.
And it was so horrific for him. He not only left, he did a documentary. He helped expose, I'm not sure if he did a documentary, but he really put together the story and changed the narrative to blow the whistle. And the poison that they use and the way that they did it. And the, like you said, if you demonize or dehumanize anything, then you can do whatever you want. So they poisoned, maimed, and killed them, and it hurt people's pets too.
Exactly. They would go into the dens where the pups were, you know, just completely helpless, and they would use poison, they would destroy pups. They would use such toxic poisons that weren't even being allowed to be used. They were out of date. And they would actually end up getting into the ecosystem and killing dogs and pets, like you said. Now, Brooks Fahey is the one who did that wonderful documentary. It's called Exposed. you can just Google it and you can probably get a sample of it.
I watched it. So, because I did go on a whole rabbit hole here. I watched about 4 documentaries and every one of them tells the same horrible stories and then tries to give us all a glimmer of hope, which I do have a glimmer of hope. There are good things, which we'll get to. So what about, and then it was also not surprising that another man in just the first chapter, Carter Niemeyer.
Yes.
He was another one. He was a wolf trapper turned wolf advocate. It's not uncommon. So tell us about Carter.
Well, Carter has actually done 2 memoirs. He's a really wonderful writer. His first memoir is called Wolfer, and the other one is just out. And he arrived in Idaho to work for the government to help kind of ease tensions between what he called the Idaho wolf hysteria and the tedious fire and brimstone style of scare tactics that were being used by a lot of the people who were afraid of the wolves. And he found himself basically in this kind of anti-wolf brand of evangelism. It is a kind of fundamentalism where people just have a dogma. And like I said, there's no reasoning with them. You get into a very emotional place. And I do want to balance this because, as you know, I grew up with a father in the Forest Service.
Right.
And I grew up on a lookout station high in the Sierra in Northern California. And I was raised with wildlife management and a hunting culture. And predator-prey relationships are in my bone and muscles. And I still eat bison burgers. You know, I'm not one of these people who's gone totally vegan. And, you know, because I was raised to really respect wild animals. And my father was one of the first people to teach me that there is no such thing as a big bad wolf. You know, he really, as a hunter and an ethical hunter, respected the wolf as a fellow predator. And I grew up with that. And many of the people in the Forest Service, you know, they go into the Forest Service to really, you know, help the ecosystem. And it's hard because sometimes, depending upon the government, they're forced into positions where they have to end up doing things like some of these people who must work for wildlife services. I mean, I don't know anyone who does that. But you can imagine being very idealistic and going into the government, and all you're given as an option is lethal management, even though you may love animals. So it's a very complex situation for even wildlife managers. But I have always felt this real love, like you, for the wolves, especially being raised up there under deer trophies that were right over my crib. I thought those deer were my babysitters, and they were very beautiful.
Right.
They had their eyes on me. They never took their eyes off me.
Some people have lamb chop mobiles above their crib, and Brenda Peterson had heads of deers. Okay. There is something really important that you brought up, though, and a disclaimer really early on. This is not a book about hunting and anti-hunting. This is not anything close to that. In fact, it's counter to that, of the need for hunting and hunting licenses. And we would be in such bad shape if hunting was forbidden. It has to happen to control populations and on and on. However, we do have to talk about predation, because the myth is, and I remember when I read the book, I sent it to a really good friend of mine who's a hunter, and I said, I'm sending you this book. Will you read it with an open mind? And he did, because he said, they kill wildlife. They kill wildlife. That's why the ranchers don't like them. And I said, read the book. And he did read the book, and it absolutely opened his mind to the other side of the story. And that happens a lot. But talk about predation. Not a big problem.
Yes. Well, I want to say first that hunters and ranchers are very different people.
Right, right.
Ranchers are economically and practically involved with cattle. And so for them, wolves can be, you know, a predator. But hunters often see the wolf, as I said, as a fellow top predator. And there's a lot of respect. In fact, my Huffington Post that got 3,000 likes was called Honorable Hunters Howl Out Against Wolf Hunts. And I interviewed all these hunters who were basically saying, you know, if you give up this, you know, landscape and you just give it over to oil or to, you know, mining interest, we can't hunt. We want to keep wilderness alive. And if that means keeping wolves on the landscape, we're for it.
Right, right.
So and it's a very complicated, it's, you know, one of the things that having done this book, I can tell you, and I'm sure with all of the work that I've seen in your podcast, we're looking for common ground. We're looking for ways we can connect instead of polarities where we just hurl insults at each other from our little safe echo chambers.
And if we look for it, it's there almost always, almost always. And I'm working very hard on remembering that in a very divisive country right now. I'm trying to think, go to common ground, go to common ground.
Yes.
So let's jump into the happy spaces, of which there are many in your book about wolves. And the happiest place for me to start would be with you sharing the story you write about in the book about how, in my words, you got chosen to be one who speaks for the wolves, all as a result of your getting lost. And I don't believe in coincidences. You got lost on the Navajo reservation, and your fate was sealed, as I would say. It's kind of like when I went to the rainforest. It's like, okay, I hear you. I'm going back, and I'm going to start Mrs. Green's World. And that was 12 years ago. So tell us about how you were chosen to be one who speaks for the wolves.
Well, sometimes when we get lost, we get found.
And yes, I love it.
Yeah, and I've always found that to be true. I get lost and I get found. And, you know, I want to preface this by saying, going back to being born on that lookout station in the High Sierra, that I learned about wolves and I learned to love what was wild and would never belong to me. What was not a pet or a daily companion, but wary, hidden away, untouchable. I loved what was not tamed or domesticated. I learned about the wolves' power and their fiercely tender protection of those they love. I wanted to grow up to be a wild wolf. So that is the preface to me getting lost and found, because you fast forward 20-some years, I'm teaching, I'm down in Arizona, and I'm spending a lot of time on the Hopi Reservation and the Navajo Reservation because they are so beautiful. And the ancient knowledge and the native wisdom and the native science I wanted to apprentice to. So one day I got completely lost, which is very easy to do on
yes,
the web.
Yes, there's not a lot of big trees that you can turn right on.
No, and I am
turn right by the big tree.
And I am directionally impaired to begin with. So there I was in my beat up old car, and I pulled into a kind of old, it was like a trading post and a gas station, and it was super hot. And I walk in, and I was just looking for some sort of water. And I should preface this by saying that my family is plagued with just being a little bit more than intuitive. I wouldn't go to psychic because we haven't really trained ourselves in that.
Right.
But we've had some experiences in our lives that have saved our lives, so we trust it. So I walk into this really dilapidated old trading post, and as I walk in, I get my first and only migraine of my life. It
wow.
was as if I had, and I was 20, 21, 22. It was as if I had had a stroke. I could barely, I leaned against the glass counter, and I just put my hand on my head, and I felt like I was going to die. And the Navajo woman came up, and I said, there's something here. I knew it wasn't my body. I knew I wasn't dying, but it felt that way. And I said, there's something here. I can feel it. It's so painful. And she looked at me, you know, this, you know, blue-eyed, faintly fair, even though we had a native blood in my father's family. But she looked at me kind of like, oh. And then she reached under all these kind of trinkets on this velvet top, and she pulled out this amazing museum-quality necklace of spiderweb turquoise and coral beads and a 1920 silver dollar and wolf teeth. And the minute she pulled it out, I had tears streaming down my face, and the pain went away. And she said, this, my father brought this home from World War I because the person... It's a skinwalker necklace. It was made to protect the person. There's my cat.
There's the cat. Welcome to the cat. It's okay.
Well, my cat world, who's very empathic. And he,
right.
And she said, we've hidden it here, and she said that someone would know it was here. And again, I looked at her, she looked at me, she was kind of like, oh boy, I'm really sorry it's you.
And you have to take this.
And I had no money. I mean, I was just teaching at the U of Arizona. I had no money. I think I had like $200 to my name. And she put it in my hand, and the minute she put it in my hand, it was warm. It was alive.
Right, right.
And I was so terrified of it. And I handed it back, and I said, oh, no, no, this is way beyond me. I don't deserve it, and I can't use it. And, you know, you need to keep it for someone in your tribe. And she pushed it back, and she said, it's awake, and you need to work with it.
Oh, Brenda, I just, like, I think I read that part like 5 times, maybe each time I read it in the book. It's so powerful, and it was so clear. You were chosen, and there was no turning back, obviously. So.
I was, but I was scared.
I bet.
Because I was young, and, you know, I was on a different reservation. I didn't feel worthy of the work. I had, you know, had that relationship to wolves as a child, but what I immediately did, which I think many people might do, is just put it in a drawer surrounded by elk skin that my father had given me from one of his hunts.
Right. Let us sit for a while.
And I just said, I respect you and I can't do anything and I'll give it to a museum. I tried to give it to a woman, a Native woman who had a museum at the Smithsonian, and she said, oh no, if this is what's happened.
I mean,
you're
powerful.
Gonna have to say,
yes,
yeah, wouldn't
so,
let me.
So powerful.
So now I'm wearing it as we talk. Very few people, it's not anything I would wear in public. Very few people have ever seen it. I keep it in a savings deposit box. When I worked, when I was writing this book, I wore it every day. I took it out for this interview. It does have work to do in the world.
Well, I feel honored that you're wearing it. And it's just like, I had everybody, full disclosure, I had to call Brenda before we officially went on air to just kind of calm myself down because all of those emotions came back. So the next part, if you can, and take as long as you want, tell us about the wolves. You know them. You study them. You've spent time with them. You love them. Tell us about your love for them and why they live so strongly within you and many others. They are so like us in many ways. So tell us about the wolves before I ask you to share some other stories.
One thing that I really had fun with in this book and the way I balanced a lot of the horror and the tragedy and the sadness was interviewing a lot of the scientists. And now many of them are women. You know, in the early days when women scientists didn't do very well and they got thrown out of programs because they cried or whatever, they have now come back with a passion. Anne-Rook Weiss, who's at the Center for Biological Diversity, Christina Eisenberg, who's a wolf scientist who wrote The Wolf's Tooth, who's a dear friend, some people I know at Wolfhaven, who we'll talk about later. But when the women went into the field of wolf research, Diane Boyd, they looked at daily life, friendships among wolves, relationships among wolves. They didn't just look at who's on top or who kills what. The predator-prey relationship has been the focus of most male science. You know, they're hunters, they're gatherers. We're gatherers, and we gather stories. So I'm going to tell you one of my favorite stories, because when you study the social life of wolves and the culture of wolves, you see how much like us they are. And this is the babysitter wolf story, which is the story of Pearl in Alaska. And a woman was up there. She was a new mother. She was working for the government. And she decided just to, every day, for 3 or 4 hours a day, study this one wolf family with pups. And the mother, you know, has to hunt to be able to nurse the pups. So she needs time, like any good mother, away from her beautiful offspring. So she went off, and she left her with her four pups with a babysitter wolf, who was kind of just learning how to babysit. Well, the wolves got into the den, and they would not come out when the mother came back to nurse them, because they were afraid they would have to cross this very difficult landscape with a lot of sharp rocks. So Pearl, the mother, was waiting to nurse them, and the babysitter wolf was trying to coax them out of the den, and they wouldn't come. So finally she realized, after all sorts of, you know, howling and everything, I have to pretend like this is a game. I have to play with them. So she began yipping and howling and jumping up, and three of the four wolves went, oh, it's a game, and they followed her back, and they got to nurse with Pearl, the mother. But there was one little wolf, healthily fearful, that wouldn't move, wouldn't budge. And the babysitter wolf tried everything. And finally, she got this idea, let's do a tug of war. So she got a caribou bone. She started, you know, putting it in the den. And of course, like our dogs or like any kind of animal that loves to play tug of war, that little wolf pup clamped on to the caribou bone and came out of the den and didn't even realize that the babysitter wolf had pulled him all the way across the rough stones to live with the mother. Now, how human is that?
That's, yes. And it's wonderful that you said the woman's perspective came alive, the mother, Earth Mother, yes, all of those things, which gives us the untold story up until this this phenomenon of more women scientists and researchers. I think I just got the name for the series I want to do, Women and Wolves, the Untold Story.
Yes.
But that's it. And they play, they mate for life, they don't run around on each other. I mean, it's like there's so many good things with it. I don't know if it's moral turpitude or the words we want to use, but they are so like us in their behaviors, yeah, and they protect each other. I mean, all of those wonderful things, and yet they become the big bad wolf. That's, to me, the irony of so much of this.
And this biologist was named Kathy Kirby. It's in the chapter called Wolves at Play. And after she, you know, watched this babysitter wolf, she wrote, it taught me many lessons to improve my own mothering child care skills. So we're learning about, now another thing wolves teach us is self-limit, which humans have a hard time with. So wolves limit their population. The only breeding pair are the alpha male and the alpha female. So the others aren't breeding. So you don't have this population
split
because they couldn't feed their families. So that's something we can learn from wolves. We can learn about compassion, because Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who wrote Living with Wolves, the National Geographic researchers who lived with those wolves in Idaho and studied them for many years, they talk about a wolf who had an injured jaw and could not hunt and could not hardly eat. And the whole family hunted for that wolf and fed that wolf. So we can learn compassion and loyalty and family values and culture. One of the chapters, my favorite chapter in the book, is called Wolf Music, because I'm a singer. I grew up in a musical
family.
And
let's talk about that now if you want. It's like, yes, it's one of my favorite chapters too. Yes. It's like, OMG, love this chapter. And Helene, the wolf musician, she's beyond wolf whisperer, I can tell you that. So do tell, let's segue into that.
Yes, just like I wanted to find women biologists who studied wolves, I wanted to find someone else who studied why they howled. Because scientists are always looking for practical reason. Like, you know, why do humans tell jokes? Is there some practical apparatus that we have to use? Why do we sing? Why do we laugh? You know, even rats laugh. So when we begin to ask these kind of cultural questions, I found this wonderful, she's a genius at the piano. She's a French pianist named Hélène Grimaud, G-R-I-M-A-U-D, the chapter's Wolf Music. And I finally got an interview with her, which was a fairly profound interview. It was very far-ranging. And she started the New York Wolf Center up in upstate New York. And she was telling me, you know, why do we just think that it's about claiming territory when they howl, or saying, back off, you know, this is my place? Why can't we look at wolves and look at them as musicians? And she told me that every wolf has a distinct howl, and they've now discovered that they have wolf dialects that are specific to certain family packs. So just like we have different accents, they have different accents, and you can kind of identify, oh, that's my family over there. And there's something that is quite wonderful called bow jest. And that is when wolves, or maybe there's only three, but they want to like give the impression that there's, you know, hundreds, they will howl in concert. And it sounds like there's a million of them. And that's a concept called bow jest. And you very rarely hear a wolf howl alone. If you go down to Wolf Haven or any of the wolf sanctuaries and you howl, this is the only wild animal that I know of that will howl with you and harmonize. They will go thirds and fifths. You know, if you go, whoa, they'll go, whoa. You know, they will, I mean, my choir director would love the wolves because they're really good at harmony. They scale up and down. They don't ever stay on the same pitch. And this howling together is a kind of social glue. You know, when we humans sing together, our hearts begin to beat as one. What is that for wolves? You know, I mean, wolves will howl to one another. They create acoustic maps. I love that idea of acoustic maps. Like, here is my acoustic territory. And this idea of wolf music, my cats now have gotten very used to wolf howls. They used to freak out and run. And now my Siamese join in.
Right, right. That should be on YouTube. That should be on YouTube. But her work, and you say her name so eloquently with the French pronunciation, but Elaine, she also, there was a story in there, if I remember correctly, about which she would play the piano in Switzerland and cows would come to the window. Yes. And then when she would go look out the window, they'd go away. But if she started playing the piano again, so there is definitely a musical connection between us and our music and animals. I mean, clearly the cows would come and then they would go away. They had no interest in her whatsoever, but they would leave when she stopped playing. So she really saw more deeply into that.
Yes. Every time I leave the house, I say to my Amazon Echo, play music for cats, because there are all sorts of animals who love dogs. They like monkeys, like violin music. Elephants like a more stable tempo of music. They relax with it. I mean, music is a great leveler, and it's a great way to communicate. One of the things that I interviewed with Hélène, I said, if you were going to compose a concerto for a wolf audience, would it be a love song and a requiem?
I remember that. I loved it. Yes.
She said, I've never been asked that question before. She said, probably I choose music with a sense of longing. That's always what I think when I hear wolves howling, endless longing.
Yes, yes. They're certainly telling their story. And one story that it would just got to me at the core of my being was about Aldo Leopold.
Yes.
It's not uncommon. So he turned literally, not from just a trapper, but I would say a somewhat malicious killer, wolf killer, to advocate. And I don't know if we have time, but there's a chapter where he describes a paragraph of actually the eye contact and what happened to him, like physically, spiritually, emotionally, to make him turn, and wrote an essay called Thinking Like a Mountain. So can you do us the best shot about that transformation?
It's on page 22 in Wolf Nation. And Aldo Leopold is one of my heroes because he had an epiphany. He was a government employee and killed many wolves in Arizona with the lethal management. But then when he found this wolf, this mother wolf, and he shot her, and she lay wounded and her pups scattered into the woods, the wounded wolf looked up at Leopold as he leaned over to catch the fierce green fire dying in her eyes. In that eye to eye with the wolf, the man is changed forever. He recognizes something new in these eyes, something known only to the wolf and the mountain. What does the mother wolf see in this young man's eyes at the moment of her death? The man will never again kill another of her kind. Her death will become a legend. Anyone who has sat vigil with the dying knows that in an instant, when the eyes fiercely focus, then fix, then extinguish their light, that light can last a lifetime. The old mother's wolf eyes have haunted Leopold and us for as long as he lived.
And You have to read the next two sentences because I'm right there with you. I have it highlighted in pink. So,
yes. She transmitted to Leopold another way of seeing his and her world. After her death, when Leopold considered the newly wolfless mountain, he realized the wild without wolves meant defoliation by deer herd, dead of its own too much.
So
that's something I really want to talk about, because we touched on hunting and my respect for wild game, that I still eat it, that my father at 92 is still eating sweet and sour moose meatballs. You know, it's a family tradition. But I want to say something about the ethical hunting and the fact that when you have no healthy fear in a prey animal, like an elk or a deer or a moose, they will overeat the vegetation. They will overeat. They will die out of overpopulation. They will run rampage over the environment and destroy it. So we actually need hunters, both wolves and human hunters, to keep these populations in check. Because when you have that healthy fear and these animals are not standing around like lawn ornaments, you know, when they go to higher ground to escape the wolves, or when they leave an area which is, you know, like a cattle farm or whatever, to go someplace where the cattle will bunch together in fear instead of wander around by themselves where they're vulnerable to wolves. The fact is that you have a very healthy environment. And we've seen from Yellowstone, and a lot of people have written about this, that when you have wolves in Yellowstone, there is balance. They stabilize the willows, they stabilize the beavers, the stream beds, there's less erosion. It's really been proven that fish, coyote, antelope, you know, elk, they all benefit when the wolves are helping to keep the balance.
And that story, the Yellowstone story, is one that to me is so compelling, because if you come from a research-based perspective or an emotional base or whatever your base of operation is, the impact of wolves on the landscape, the natural order of things, the balance of nature, it's so clear of the importance that wolves play in the balance of nature. And I mean, I think it answers the question, what does the wild look like without wolves? It's not good.
Right.
It's just not good.
And remember, wolves don't eat everything. You know, they share and they return.
Right,
and they'll,
right.
They'll put it in the snow and they'll come back and have a frozen dinner later. But they often leave lots for other animals like coyotes and bears and, you know, smaller animals to eat. So they actually feed everybody. And the wolves help the soil. They help climate change because they, you know, balance the ecosystem them a little bit more. So all of these benefits are not talked about, and they're science and they're proven.
Like beyond anyone's doubt, that's, I think, what we can look for in our lives as a validation for that. So another chapter in your book, you couldn't pick one for me that I didn't love, and you have stories within stories, but I loved the chapter Old Growth and Young Hals.
Yes.
There are many stories within stories in this. And would you highlight one or two of them? I'd love you to tell us a little bit more about Jim and Jamie Dutchers, because the impact they have on their audience and the plight of wolves in general is profound.
Yes, that was when I went down and I was brave, as brave as some of these little kids who climbed these huge ponderosa pines.
I loved that story and I could so see me in it. It was like, oh God, please don't ask me to do this.
My knees were sewing machine knees as I went up. And kids were so much, they were so high in the old growth. They were way up there, you know, yelling down. And, you know, of course, they were protected with all sorts of climbing gear and everything. But I didn't go as high as they did. But it really reminded me of some stories that the Dutchers told me. I interviewed them when they were here with the National Geographic. And they had a great quote that I have in the book. And they said that the wolf hunting and the culling of the wildlife managers shows no science or real understanding of the species survival. That's what Jim said. We can't treat wolves like rabbits or deer or like something that simply grows back. Just imagine if you killed off most of the members of your family and expected the animals to go on as if nothing devastating had happened. And That is really proven by much more recent research with the Dutchers and others out of University of Oregon that shows that, you know, when you go and you practice lethal management and you kill an alpha female of a pack, who's the teacher, who's the mother or the alpha male, what you have left are these young pups who don't have a healthy fear of, you know, ranchers or livestock. They don't know how to hunt yet on their own. And so they go for the easiest prey. And so they're like teenagers without the parents. So, of course, it makes more destabilization of the pack. It lends itself to more depredation of the livestock. And this is something we're really trying to get across, that actually when you practice lethal management and especially take out the alpha and the teachers and the older wolves, you make the family pack not only less likely to survive, but trouble. And so it's really counterproductive and counterintuitive, and we really need to find other ways. But getting the government to change and go from 100 years of lethal management is a slow process. And I will say this for the ranchers. I just did an interview on NPR a while ago with some ranchers who are about sustainable ranching, and they understand this dynamic, and they accept it. And even though some of them won't go so far as to say we will never have lethal management, they are really learning non-lethal, non-consumptive. There are all sorts of things that we can do to do prevention. One is fladry, which are these plastic red flags you put on your fences, which wolves are afraid of. Wolves are very wary of us, rightly so. There are boom boxes. There are range riders, guys who go out on their horses and patrol the cattle. There is a very successful sheep highway in Idaho. Suzanne Stone, another woman biologist who is down there teaching prevention not only in Idaho but around the world. And they've only lost 30 sheep since 2007 to wolves because they're using all these preventative things. And they have thousands of sheep on this sheep highway that go past wolves, and they are not killed because they are using prevention.
So another story that is just, you know, there's another proof. Here we go, counting the numbers. You can't refute it. But within old growth and young hows, we have to pay homage to Story Warren, because to me, the youth in all the national conferences I'm attending and staying in touch, you know, the kids at Green Corps, and to me, a kid is anyone under 40 at this point, but these are young kids in their 20s. But Story Warren, you know, there's all kinds of pink highlighting around that. And I just want to read something about, she started Kids for Wolves.
Right.
And I highlighted this asterisk when you asked her, why did she start it? She says, Story's face darkens. And to me, think about this, everybody. She is a teenager, a teenager. Right. After they shot the female matriarch, 06 and 754M, her mate's brother, outside the Yellowstone Park boundaries, I was so upset that I went to my parents and I said, I'm sick of you adults not getting anything done. Can I open an Instagram page for kids and wolves? So again, it was coming from a place of pain. And look at the impact she's had with kids.
She's wonderful. And I loved interviewing her in the book and the work that she's doing. I want to say that after I did Wolf Nation, it was such a difficult book to write. And it was the research. I was working 12, 15 hours a day to get this book out on time because the politics of wolf killing was going on so much. But what I did then was begin to write children's books as a way.
And I love them, and I have them. I love them.
Oh, good.
Joy, joy, joy.
Yes, and it gave me so much hope because, like Story, and these little kids are so ecologically advanced. And the book I just brought out with Sasquatch is called Lobo, A Wolf Family Returns to the Wild. And it was taken from Wolf Nation. And I said to the editor, let's make this a kid's book. We got these great photos by Annie Marie, who's a National Geographic, you know, photographer. I mean, these pups are so adorable. And I got to study them at Wolf Haven, which is the other wolf book I did. And I got to go down there through a remote camera and watch them grow. Because you can't, you know, imprint on these wolves because they're going to maybe go back to the wild. And so Lobos, A Wolf Family Returns to the Wild, was this wonderful story of these wolf pups of the Mexican gray wolf, who were chosen as a species survival program to actually be returned to the wild. And I got to watch them. Imagine how it was to see them grow up and then go down there and watch them. Hopa, the mother, and Brother, the father, you know, were incredible parents. And they, you know, suddenly they went from this incredible wolf sanctuary at Wolf Haven to being in vans, in you know, these kind of carriers, and then put on Alaska Jet. Can you imagine what the passengers might have thought if they knew there were six wolves in the baggage?
No. Depending upon who the passengers were, if it was me, I'd want to go down there and, and travel with them. Yeah. But some other people would say, stop the plane.
That's right. They'd say, we've got a terrorist on board.
So if you don't mind, and I'm assuming you have the book in front of you, but on page 110,
yes,
halfway down, I think this is such an important message for what you talked about for Common Ground. And this is what Story said about her social media interaction with people. And it starts, and I love you to read it because I love hearing your voice, but the paragraph that starts, when I first hear from a young rancher, could
I'm
you read
you.
That? I would love you to read that.
When I first hear from a young rancher or hunter, Story says, it usually starts with something hateful or violent, and I always try to begin a civil conversation. I ask them questions about why they dislike wolves. Then I can also learn a lot. Sometimes when I talk to these other kids and show them actual data, like how many cattle wolves actually kill, or examples of ranchers successfully using non-lethal tools, there's a chance for an open exchange. Kids know what their parents tell them, and often there's no other point of view in their communities. So I just listen and keep asking them what their experience with wolves is. Then I tell them mine. So this is what I think is so important about finding common ground and why I really enjoyed that other NPR interview. When I talked to a rancher directly and we found common ground, he liked that I still ate game. He liked that my father was a hunting culture. I liked that he was part of a sustainable landscape and that he was working with other people, even though, you know, he is in a ranching situation where most people are anti-wolf. And we are the future. We are the future, and these kids are the future. And when I wrote these three children's books, Lobo and then Wild Orca, because, you know, orcas are the wolves of the sea. And
right,
I spent,
right,
you know, many decades with dolphins and marine mammals. It was such a wonderful healing to be able to write for kids. And when I go into schools, they're so far ahead of us. They wear wolf t-shirts, you know. They howl with me. They're really there. And that gives me so much hope.
And it's just, I mean, talk about a healing for you. One of the questions I was going to ask you, since it was so hard for me to read this book, how hard it must have been for you to write this book, because you had to face some really the basest, the most vile part of human nature, and you did, and you shared it, and then you brought us to the point of hope and possibility and change and a brighter future and engagement in what we have to do. So it's worth taking the journey because you take care of us. That's how I felt. You
Thank
took care of us. And that
Thank
that
you.
Raw emotion that it's like, I can't do this. And I don't think I've ever bought a book for so many people that I have that. And I just, during this interview, I thought of another person that might actually help me with a Women and Wolves series when I go to Washington in April, because it's just, it's in me. I feel like I got chosen to bring a lot of these together with your help and highlight especially the role of women. It's, we did a series on women and climate change because their voices are often underrepresented as well. So I have two more questions, and you and I have talked about this, and Kelly and I have talked about this, that there's a part two to this, and it can be part of highlighting the children's books and that journey, but more detail about the book, which will come at another time. But I have a hard question to ask, and then I'd love to end on El Lobo Returns Home, because that's going to get everybody. So my hard question is, you know, when there's, I don't have any expectation for the answer, but to me, what we've done to the American wolf in the United States mirrors what we have done as a global community, what we've done to the planet, what we do to people because of the need for power that human beings have, oppression and elimination. It's one of our patterns. Do you see a parallel with that? Do you tie that in? It's not just that we're doing it to the wolves. We're doing it. We're eradicating the planet, and we treat some people. There are people on this planet that want certain human beings to go away. This young lady that I interviewed yesterday, 17 years old, Brenda, Jaden Lim, she talked about the genocide of the Native Americans, and she calls them Native people. She doesn't say Native Americans. They're Natives. That's it, period. It's Natives. And how she, in kindergarten, she stood up and said, I protest Columbus Day. My great-great-great-grandfather was here before Columbus. He didn't discover America. So she was starting at 5 with the message. But we wanted to kill all of the people that lived here. Let's be honest. We spent millions of dollars in government money to kill those savages.
It's the same thing. It's absolutely the same thing. My co-author for several books, Linda Hogan, the wonderful Chickasaw writer, has an essay in her book Dwellings called Deify the Wolf. I would recommend everyone read it. The Native perspective is, yes, you know, we kill what we fear. We kill what is already on the territory. If you look at maps of where wolves were before Europeans came, they are everywhere. They were everywhere. They should be everywhere. But we have always believed that we need to be first on the landscape and the top predator. And so we will kill anything that's there before us. And we found that that doesn't work because we kill off the wisdom of the native scientist. We kill off the wolves who help us balance the ecosystem. And the alternate to this is Jacques Cousteau, who wrote, we protect what we love. So Gina, this is all about love. This is all about love being stronger than fear. You know, in our choir, we have a song that we sing at all the weddings called Settin' as a Seal. And the lyric is, love is stronger than fear. And I believe that about humans. You know, I'm not one of these people who hates humans and only loves animals. I love humans. I just think we have a lot to learn. And all of us are trying to teach ourselves and others that compassion is the way and not contempt. And not trying to eliminate anything that doesn't look like us. Anything that isn't, you know, we look at the other and we think, oh, that's not us. We better get rid of it. But everyone from the Dalai Lama to all of our great prophets in every religion teach us that if we can learn to love the other, we will have learned what it is to truly be a soul evolving in this world.
I just want everybody to sit with that. And I think it's weird. And I am going to get choked up here a little bit. It doesn't happen very often. And I'm proud of myself for like keeping it under control for a bit. But I think it's very, I don't know what the word is. I'm not surprised. I can't act like I'm surprised. But the next two shows we're having, we do a local show, our Down to Earth. And the name of the show, and this was not intentional on my part or Kelly's, but the name of the show is Spread the Love with Donations. And it's about goodwill and the incredible things they're doing with youth in our community. And it's on Valentine's Day. And the next one, here is Brenda talking about love. I heard a woman named Jacqueline Martinez Garcelle speak, and she's the head of the Latino Community Foundation in Northern California. And the title of the show is Unleashing the Power of Love in Philanthropy. And I already did that recording with her. And she said what you did. We have to talk about love more because it's so easy to talk about hate. And you highlight that in such a beautiful, profound and important way. We've got to start talking a lot more about love to switch the energy that's out there. And it's easy for me to jump to the other side at times now. I can tell you that.
Well, kids, you know, here we are. When I go into the schools, the kids say, what can we do? And I say, adopt an animal.
Yes.
Preferably a wild animal, since, you know, when we adopt our pets, we're very good to them, we hope. But wild animals, you know, they need our help. So on Valentine's Day, adopt a wolf. Or go to Wolf Haven and adopt a wolf, or contribute to, you know, many of the wolf organizations. NRDC is a great one that is helping.
Yes.
Wolves. And
yes.
You know, do something for a wild animal. And then I say to the kids, apprentice yourself, as I did, to the wolves and the dolphins and learn about them. I have a huge library of wolf and whale, and it's that's something that I will leave as part of my legacy. I use it now for research. But if you adopt an animal for your lifetime, think what you can do for that animal and for yourself.
Forever. And it changes the world. You don't have to go do this big thing. It's that one act that can have such a ripple effect. And I just have to, when I first started with Mrs. Green's World, I don't know how it happened, but these kids came across my path, Carter and Olivia Reese. And I did an interview with them. They started an organization at 8 and 9. I think Livy was 8 and Carter was 9. They're in outside of Atlanta, and they started an organization, not kidding, called One More Generation. It was a nonprofit. They're now in their teens. We've watched them grow up. Kelly and I have become friends with Jim and their family. Their mission was to prevent certain species, and it started with a gift that their aunt gave them to save the jaguar. And they said, what do they have to save the jaguar for, Dad and Mom? What is that all about? And so at 8 and 9, and I think Livy will be a vet, and Carter, he'll probably be head of the UN someday. I mean, the journeys that they've been on and where they have spoken and the children that they have mobilized in this world. But it is that children message of do one thing. And then they got stories about the jaguar that their aunt adopted for them. And, you know, these organizations kept the kids connected, and now they're making a profound difference in the world. So let's end on this incredible up note. Normally, there's like last words from Mrs. Green. I want last words to be from Brenda Peterson. So tell us about El Lobo Returns Home, the last chapter in your book, before the epilogue, which is also great reading. Don't skip over the epilogue, folks, because you're going to miss some precious jewels. So tell us about El Lobo Returns Home.
So if you have children, get Lobos, A Wolf Family Return to
yes,
the Wild.
Yes,
the
yes, yes.
Version.
Just, even if they just look at the pictures, it's Melt City.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you can go on my website, BrendaPetersonBooks.com, and you can see lots of photos of the mother and father and the pups. So El Lobo Returns Home, the kids' book, is what the kids should read, and Wolf Nation has El Lobo Returns Home as part of a chapter at the end. But as I said, I was called to Wolf Haven, which is another photo essay book that I did that has these great photos, to study this family of Mexican gray wolves. And remember, the Mexican gray wolf were the wolf teeth that were on my wolf necklace that I found when I was in my 20s. So flash forward like 3 decades, and there I am being called to study a Mexican gray wolf family. So it's all full circle. And when I first met them, the pups were about 4 weeks old. And again, I looked at them through remote cameras because you can't go near them because they need to be wild and not in any way open to humans. So in March of 2015, I went down there. And they had just been born in April. And they were incredibly beautiful. I mean, they had those big ears and those big eyes, and the mother was called Hopa, and the father was called Brother. It was their first parenting job together, and they were very good parents. One thing in the children's book, I have this fun facts, because, you know, kids love fun facts. The favorite food of the pups was blood sickles. Kids love that, you know, blood sickles. Ah, that's so cool. So there they were. They didn't know if this family among, you know, New York Wolf Center has Mexican wolves. There are several, there's a endangered wolf center in Minnesota. There's several places that have the species survival program going with the federal government. So we didn't know if this family would be chosen. They were. And when they were chosen to be the family returning to the wild, we were all just, you know, so thrilled and kind of scared, because what if they didn't make it?
You know, right.
What if they couldn't adapt to the wild? So in April of 2016, they were transported, as I said before, by plane and by van to the Ladder Ranch, which is in New Mexico, which was a much bigger landscape, where immediately they learned, I mean, they were hunting. They were hunting eagles. They were hunting, you know, small prey, squirrels, etc., the minute they got to this ranch. So there was no fear that they wouldn't, you know, be able to fend for themselves. And then they had to stay there because they realized that Hopa was again pregnant. So during that entire journey by plane and van, she was pregnant, which we didn't really know. And so she gave birth to another second litter of six lobos. So we had four, we had 11, you know, in the family, which is a lot. And then in June and August of 2016, they were adapting at the Ladder Ranch. And finally, we got the call of in December 2016 that Mexico would take these wolves into this remote forest that was partially owned by, you know, one of us, and then partially a kind of government biosphere. And there they are today, thriving. And there are hardly any gray wolves, I mean, Mexican gray wolves left in Mexico. So they are part of the repopulating of that native population. And every day in my meditation, I include Hopa, brother, and their family, that they may thrive.
And I don't want to say anything else except thank you. Let's everybody sit with that and think about it. And the one thing I will say, Brenda, because I always have something else to say, as you have come to learn, is you don't want to know how many hours my husband and I have spent in Arizona and New Mexico looking for the Mexican gray wolf. Yes. Hours and hours and hours. And there is a way with the Defenders of Wildlife that I can connect to do it. I haven't done it, but it is, I am going to see a wolf. I am going to see a wolf in the wild, make no doubt about it. So,
You might have to get lost and found.
Oh gosh, I love that. I'm hoping, and I'll call you when it happens. I promise I will. I got lost and found in the Amazon, which certainly changed the course of my life forever. 12 years ago, somebody found me and knocked on my head and said, go back and tell the world about the importance of the rainforests. And so that was part of what I got called to do. So anyway, thank you, my friend. And I hope our paths will cross in person soon. And I hope that I will be successful in having the time and the resources to collect some of these and amplify the voices of the wolves, because I'm feeling like that's one of my callings as well. So thank you so very much. And we'll talk again. Everybody, everything that Brenda talked about, websites, all of this, Kelly will put all of those things, Brenda's website, the names of the books, some of the organizations she mentioned, they will be on the webpage when the podcast is released. She does a great job about that, and we've had lots of listeners thank us. They don't have to go searching and clicking around. So, Brenda, again, thank you, be well, and be in touch.
Do you want to end with a howl?
Yes! Oh my gosh!
I think we should, and I'll watch my harmony. So do you want me to start?
Or start it. Start it.
Okay, ready?
Yes.
Good job.
Now I have to go because I'm crying. Thanks, everybody. Cry more. The world needs empaths.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Brenda.